Shall we begin?
So, as you know, we have a test coming up on Thursday. And I mentioned last time that you got your essay questions, and I had several tips for how you might study the place of houses. Just reiterate those for a minute. I think it would be good to really pay attention to the first three chapters, the one on Edgartown, the one on Santa Barbara, and the one on Sea Ranch. Of course, we talked about Sea Ranch in class in a previous lecture. And in particular, you should be looking at how do these things make a community, the kinds of issues we were talking about last time. How do these things add up to a larger community? And a little bit of what we're going to be talking about this time, but what is the visual communication of some of these communities? What's the difference between Edgartown with its little, like every house is in a little tuxedo, all kind of dressed alike, and making a kind of community, even public buildings, residences, kind of in the same vocabulary, versus, say, Santa Barbara, which is completely different, kind of everybody behind walls, big hedges, kind of Mediterranean feeling, dominated by landscape. What are the differences in lifestyle and feeling between, say, New England, which is a very distinctive place to live, or Southern California, which is a different but distinctive place to live? So those are very important to understand in Edgartown and Santa Barbara. And then another thing I said, as well as write about them, and they talk about their own buildings, and you should be able to understand what their buildings are about, and in particular in that chapter called Ours, that would be a good one to look at. And then just in general, when they use examples that we also talked about in class or by architects we also talked about in class, those are places to pay attention. You know, Frank Lloyd Wright, I think they talk a good bit about falling water. We talked about falling water in class. They talk some about Palladio. They talk some about Mies van der Rohe, you know, some of these that we've looked at in class. And in fact, today we're looking at a building by Thomas Jefferson. They spend a good bit of time on Monticello by Thomas Jefferson. Okay, so this whole segment has been about human factors, and very distinct from issues of form or issues of physical considerations. And human factors really have to do with, in that first lecture, we were talking about how it can influence behavior or activities and this relationship between form and function. And then in the last two lectures, this notion of even maybe goes beyond just accommodating an activity or a function, but there is a whole ethos of whether or not it is supporting your life, whether it is supporting self-realization, whether there is this notion of humanism, and the whole idea also of, or is it a vehicle for kind of pretension or putting somebody down or saying, I'm bigger, I'm stronger, I'm better. That's also a possibility. But there are all kinds of, messages at the scale of an individual, a door handle or a piece of furniture that either is there and seems like it's built very much to support you as a human being or not, all the way up to a neighborhood or a town or a city. Is it meant to support your lifestyle, your attitudes, your way of living, your own self-realization? So those are important issues in human factors. Now today we're going to take a slightly different take on human factors. We're going to be looking at meaning. How are buildings a vehicle for communicating, for saying something about the culture or the individual or whatever? How do they communicate? And we've mentioned before this power of visual communication. So all of you, consciously or unconsciously, communicate things about yourself visually. Whether you wear your hair long or you wear your hair short, whether you keep your hair completely bedhead and all messed up or carefully groomed and parted, whether you wear t-shirt and gym shorts always, everywhere, or whether you kind of, you know, wear a nice blouse and a skirt even occasionally. These are things that communicate something about you, and people read that. There was a guy a couple of semesters ago who had ROTC right after this class, and pretty much every class period he came in a military uniform. I swear this was, I mean, people treated him very differently. He was different from everyone else because he was in a military uniform. I had a kid one semester that always wore a coat and tie, always. Man, that really sets you apart. It says something, doesn't it? Many of you are sitting here wearing shirts that say something about where you go to school and some kind of loyalty to UT. Others of you have other kinds of messages on your clothes. We're communicating with the way we dress, the way we wear our hair, the way we, you know, the way we look. And it could be conscious or it could be unconscious. But people do read things from that. And it certainly is true that corporate America understands this is very fundamentally important, how they portray themselves to all of us as consumers. So even something as simple as a logo, you think of IBM as a company, and probably everybody can conjure in their head the IBM logo. It's three simple block letters, IBM, very geometrical. They're a very cool blue. This is all about a company that makes machines. They're about precision. They're reliable, they're dependable. And all of that is communicated very beautifully in that logo. And contrast that, for example, with the logo of McDonald's, which is these big, yellow, loopy letters, you know, and the M like golden arches and kind of Ronald McDonald, fun, lively, kids. A completely different ethos of that company that's communicated just in their logo. And it's very, very carefully staged. They want you to think certain things just by that logo. And then there's even, you know, very much in their packaging and in advertising, all of those messages are communicated to you visually, and they're quite potent, quite powerful. So, for example, there's a book by Malcolm Gladwell called Blink. Anybody read Blink? Few of you. So in Blink, he makes the claim that we have a reaction just so quick that it's like in the time you blink, we get some kind of reaction to something, a gut reaction. And he uses some examples of how companies use that gut reaction to sell their products. So he talks about the fact that in the, I think, 1960s, 50s or 60s, they came out with margarine as a replacement for butter. And at first, no one would buy margarine. Why would I buy margarine? It was the same price as butter. It didn't taste as good as butter. Why would I want to buy margarine? And it was a complete failure. And then someone came along and they decided they were going to sell this margarine stuff. It was a lot cheaper to produce than butter. So you can make a lot bigger profit on it. So what they did was they named it Imperial Margarine. Imperial, okay, that's like for an emperor. That's really high class. They put a little crown on the label, an emblem of royalty. They spent a lot of money on their packaging and made this gold foil that was really shiny and very elegant letters that said Imperial Margarine. And so they marketed it as something snobby, something special, something important, something high class. And it sat there in the dairy case next to your regular old butter, and it looked superior. And Imperial Margarine was the first margarine that really took off. It really sold. And it was, and after that, it actually through Imperial Margarine, in the 60s and 70s, margarine almost completely replaced butter. People wouldn't eat butter in their house. They were eating margarine. Margarine seemed to be the superior product. Over time, that's kind of faltered. But it was sold to us and not sold to us nutritionally or price or anything like that, just a feeling, just a communication about this is better, this is more elegant, this is more high class than that butter. Also in Blink, Malcolm Gladwell talks about these two kinds of brandy. One was Christian Brothers brandy and one was E&J brandy. And they were the two big competitors for the brandy market in the United States. And in a taste test, there was one of them that always won. It was just a superior brandy. It was better. But the market share of this one brandy just kept falling and falling and falling. And they couldn't understand it. Our product is better. People in a blind test, they always prefer our brandy. But we're losing market share. And they realized what it was the other guys had a beautiful bottle that looked like a brandy bottle. It looked like the snifter, you know, and very, very crusty and royal looking, and with a little gold foil cap on it, and shaped like that, you know, not like a tall wine bottle. And sure enough, when these other guys who had the superior product put it in a fancy badass bottle, they got their market share back again. So there are all kinds of tests with people where they give a blind taste test and they choose one. Oh yes, this tastes much better. But then they put it in a container and then they might choose the other one. So they say it tastes better because of the look of the container. And they're just judging taste. They say it tastes better because of some visual message they're getting about that. So these are powerful things. And we think that really works at the level of your t-shirt or at the level of your haircut or at the level of a box of margarine. Think how powerful the visual environment is. The whole freaking architectural environment is in communicating messages about whether you want to eat at this restaurant or you don't want to eat at this restaurant. Even maybe whether that looks like a really great church to go to, or that doesn't look like my kind of church. Or that looks like the kind of university I'd like to attend, or, oh no, that doesn't feel right to me. All of this is visual communication. Now I'm going to say that there are three different kinds of visual communication, three different ways that we communicate, especially at an architectural scale, with people around us. The first we're going to call literal direct communication. Literal direct communication. And what this is, it just says, it shows you an image, you're supposed to think of that image, and that association is all you're supposed to be thinking about. So an example of that might be a billboard on the highway that says, "Eat more beef," and there's a big old steer there that you see beef, cow. The message is literally, that's a cow, that's beef. That's what you're meant to think about. That's literal direct communication. Then the second kind of communication is literal indirect communication. Now again, it's a literal thing that you're looking at, but it maybe isn't meant to, you know, your mind is not just supposed to stay there on that literal thing. It's supposed to remind you of something else. And then by that reminder, that's the real message you're supposed to be getting. So let's say a similar billboard on the highway, and it's got Bevo on it, big longhorn steer, and it says, "Go Horns." Well, now that is a cow, but we're not supposed to think of Bevo, his cowness, or we're certainly not supposed to think of his beefness. We're supposed to think of him as an emblem of the University of Texas. So it's literally a cow in the same sense. But it's indirect in that we're not supposed to stop at cow. We're supposed to make that association of Bevo with the University of Texas. So there's literal direct communication. There's literal indirect communication. And then a third kind of communication is abstract
communication, where we're not really looking at some literal thing at all. It's a combination of some colors, some textures, some proportions, some shapes that make us feel something. And it's that visceral, gut kind of reaction to those colors or shapes or textures, that abstract communication that's actually the goal there. So we got literal direct communication, we got literal indirect communication, and abstract communication. So let's look at a few examples of these. The first example we're looking at, for some reason, the clickers. Do what? Excellent, thank you. Way to go, Luke. Okay. Literal direct communication. And the first example we're looking at here is some temples in India that are ancient. We're done in 930 to 1050 AD. So these are more than about 1,000 years old. And they're in amazingly great condition. They're in the middle of freaking nowhere in India. You have to make a pilgrimage out to them. There may be 30 or 40 temples in this district around Khajuraho, and it's a very, very sacred place in the Hindu religion. So you can see these series of temples. There's another one, there's another one. And so they're just scattered around in kind of groups and precincts, but 30 or 40 of these temples in Khajuraho. And they were built over quite a long period of time. And a tremendous amount of effort put into them by a culture that, you know, didn't have that many resources, but they were pouring their resources into building these temples. Interesting thing is they don't really have much interior. You don't go inside this temple and, like, have a worship service. That's not what the Hindu religion is about. So often inside there's just a tiny little place to maybe say a prayer or leave a gift or something like that. But the outsides are incredibly elaborate. In some ways, they are pure meaning. They're just there as a building, not to accommodate some activity, but more to be seen and to give a message to the people. So what is this message, and how'd that come about? So I have been to Khajuraho twice, once when I was in my 20s, and once about 5 or 6 years ago. And the time I went in my 20s, I was dirt poor, and I was, you know, traveling on minimum budget. And so the guy I got to drive me out there was just a guy who had a beat-up, like, 20-year-old black Ford that looked like it was going to fall apart, and he took me out there. So he had his very clear ideas about how this precinct developed and what it meant to him. And so I'm not sure this is, it's not necessarily true, but it is something that it meant to him. So this is the story he told me. He told me that way, way back then, all the rich people, they sent their kids to be raised by the Hindu priests. So when a kid was 2 or 3 years old, he'd be sent off to the priest, and then the priest would raise them until they were 13, 14, 15 years old. Then there would be an arranged marriage that the family set up, and they would be married to another 13, 14, 15-year-old girl, and that's how life worked. So in the monastery where they were raised, the priests were celibate. So it was all an all-male environment with the male priest and the male children. And so there was a kind of, you know, sex was just not something you talked about or had anything to do with. It was profane. So kind of a bad thing happened. These kids would grow up, they'd have this arranged marriage, they didn't even know this girl. When they got married, they're only like 13, 14 years old. So they, you know, have a little sex, but it's not really, and it's almost seen like it's a compromise of your religion. Like, okay, the real thing was when I was in the monastery, all the priests, they were celibate. So these guys were being celibate. And the bad thing about that was they just weren't making any babies. And so this was, all the rich people were not making babies, and all the poor people were making babies like crazy. And it was going to be a bad situation because, obviously, there wouldn't be any rich people to send their kids to soup, and that was a way that the priest made a living. So, you know, it was going to put the priests out of business. It was putting the rich families out of business. This was not a good thing. So according to my driver, then at a certain point they decided, well, we're going to build this precinct that will help us solve this problem. And we're going to find a way to communicate to these young men that sexuality is okay, sexuality is good, and that's something you'd want to do. And because it's right there on the temple, it would give a kind of, it wouldn't diminish your conviction to your religion to have sexuality. In fact, it would be seen as, you know, reinforcing what the religion was about. So the idea was that they built these enormous temples, they carved them out of stone, enormous amount of labor, and they depicted all of these aspects of life in them. And one of the things they depicted a lot was sexuality. So you would see these beautiful, voluptuous women, and then the kids would get this idea, okay, sexuality, that this is connected to religion. And in fact, there are sort of portrayals of exactly how you're supposed to do this. Now, I want to tell you, do not try this one at home. That one, whew. So it got to be a little more than just instructional visual representation of procreation. And it began to be a kind of, I don't know, exotic and recreational kind of thing. But all over these temples, there are these depictions of sexuality. And according to my driver, this just did the job. You know, suddenly they're popping out babies and solve the problem. Lots more babies to support the monastery, lots more heirs for the rich families. Everything's good. I love that story. I freaking love that story. But then when I went back 5 or 6 years ago, I could afford a guy to show me around who was a Brahmin. This is the upper class Indian person. In fact, his father was a very famous yogi, and he was very, very thoroughly knowledgeable about Hindu religion. And he showed me around this precinct. And of course, he said that story was complete bullshit. But the real story is not so different, really. But what he said is that there are really four things in Hindu religion that your life is about. Your life is about duty, or what they call dharma. Your life is about material gain, money, materialistic things, which is artha. Your life is about sexuality, love, pleasure, that's kama. And if you have a good sense of duty, and if you work hard and get material things, and if you have love and pleasure and sexuality, then you can reach salvation, which is the fourth element, which is nirvana. So your life is about duty, about materialistic gain, about sexuality, and about salvation. And that in Khajuraho, they're depicting all of those things. So in fact, there are sculptures here that are talking about, and you can see, you know, people taking care of their families. You can see people working in the fields and getting materialistic gain. You can see people having sex. And what he said is that in Hindu religion, sexuality is one of those four key elements to a fulfilled life. So it would make sense that there on the temples, there would be depictions of all of your life, including sexuality as a part of that. And as we went around and looked carefully at all of these sculptures, that really was borne out. But there was a way of seeing sexuality very much as parallel and a part of everyday life. And it's quite a powerful thing in Hindu religion. And that's how in Hindu religion we get the Kama Sutra, which is sort of instructional sex guide. And it is very much a part of the religion. They say in Hindu religion that Hinduism is not necessarily just a religion, it's just a way of life. It's about your whole life. So the temples at Khajuraho are depicting all of that. Now this is literal direct communication. Got it? Literally people having sex. What am I supposed to be thinking about? How hard is this? People having sex, right? Okay. So literal direct communication. And these powerful things that have been sitting there for centuries. The day I was there most recently, I was there on a holiday. Oh my God, it was fantastic. There were thousands of people who had come from the entire region around. When they have a holiday, they would go and be at these temples and enjoy the temples, and they've been communicating for centuries the role of all of these things in their religion. It's a powerful way to talk about the values of that religion. That's literal direct communication. The second method I talked about was literal indirect communication. So now we look at something, but we aren't necessarily supposed to stop at that. It represents something else. And the example we're looking at here is, we're going to be looking at the University of Virginia campus by Thomas Jefferson in Charlottesville, Virginia. Now, this is the first state-sponsored university in the country. Thomas Jefferson, and some of you may know the name Thomas Jefferson. I mean, he's very, very well-known architect. He did the State House in Richmond in Virginia. He did many houses in Virginia and around there. He did his own house, Monticello, and he did the University of Virginia campus. He was self-taught in architecture. He spent 8 years in France, very carefully going around and sort of cataloging the architecture he observed. He had a huge library, in particular a library of Palladio's work. He was very, very fond of Palladio. This was a well-trained, very erudite architect. Now, as a sideline, he also wrote the Declaration of Independence and was President of the United States. But it's important to remember that really, Thomas Jefferson was an architect. And he was serious, I'm serious, he was very serious about his architecture. He did that, that was a big, big part of his life. So he wanted, when he was president, he wanted to have a national university. He believed that a part of democracy was that if you're going to have a democracy, you need to have an educated populace. They need to know what they're voting on. So he felt like education was absolutely essential, but he could not convince Congress to appropriate the money to have a national university. So after he stopped being president in 1808, he then devoted the rest of his life. He died in 1836, so a couple of decades there, that he devoted to creating a university for the Commonwealth of Virginia. So if you can have a national one, you could have a state one. And he convinced the legislature in Virginia to fund it, and then he designed it, designed the buildings, designed the curriculum, hired the initial faculty, and started the University of Virginia. And that was the first state university. We're the heirs at University of Texas of this idea that Thomas Jefferson had. So he's inventing a new institution. How am I going to communicate to people what we're about here at this institution? And so he thinks, what is the right way to depict this new entity that I'm creating? And he decides that he will make the main building, the main focus of the whole campus, virtually a replica of the Pantheon in Rome. There's the University of Virginia Library at the apex of the campus, and there is the Pantheon. So this is literal communication. What am I supposed to be thinking of? The Pantheon. But is that all? Am I supposed to think that's a temple to Greek gods? No, it's meant to be indirect communication. Now, you have to put yourself to some extent in the mindset of someone who might have been going to University of Virginia in those early days. All education at that point reached back to the classics. So you would have learned in college, you would have studied Greek and Latin as languages, not to speak them, but that was the language of Western civilization, of the classics. And so you'd study Greek and Latin, and you certainly would have known all of the Greek buildings and architecture and the Roman buildings and architecture. That was kind of the basis of education at that point. So he's making you be reminded of the Pantheon. And I think he's using the Pantheon for four reasons. One thing the Pantheon is standing for here is the notion of a republic. The Romans had a republican government. We think of Greece and Rome as the beginning of democracy. They had representative government. They had a Senate. A lot of our structure for the American government came from the structure of those republics in Greece and Rome. So by choosing the Pantheon, he reminds us of our cultural heritage in Greece and Rome, and the fact that we're a representative government, we're a republic, we're a democracy. So that is a building that says democracy. The second thing is that the actual building of the Pantheon was a very interesting building in that culture. It was built by the Emperor Hadrian, and Hadrian was a great builder, fantastic builder, and Hadrian was a little disturbed by something that was happening in Rome at the time. All of the people, of course, there are lots of Roman gods. There's Apollo, and there's Diana, and there's Venus, and there's Neptune, and people would have their favorite god, and I'm like, I'm a Neptune guy, you know, and sea god, I'm a Apollo guy. And so they had all these temples to Diana, the huntress, or to Neptune, and people were beginning to have these cults, and then the cults were actually arguing and warring with each other. I'm a Diana person, you know? That's better than your stupid Neptune person. And so it began to divide the people in Rome into these cults. And Hadrian didn't think that was a good thing. So he decided that he would build a temple to all the gods. And it would be for everyone. And it would be so magnificent and so much better than any of the other temples that people would see that unification, that's really where it's at, not that separation in warring cults. So he builds the Pantheon, and that's what it means, Pantheon, all the gods. So he built the Pantheon as this unification of the people in Rome. And that's exactly what Thomas Jefferson is trying to talk about here. We had 13 colonies. They were all kind of fighting with each other at this period. And he wanted them to pull together and to be, you know, unified. So he uses this representation that talks about unity, unification, all the gods. So it's talking about democracy, it's talking about unification. The third thing is that this actually is, and there you can see the Pantheon, the arrangement of how it sits in the landscape and in relation to the other buildings has a message as well. The Pantheon sat like this, and then it had the Stoa in front of it, and that was a big marketplace and a forum for discussion. So right now, things have been built around it in Rome, and it's a much smaller little piazza in front. But originally, this was a big rectangular space where debates, dialogue, interaction occurred. And that's where you'd have your rallies or your demonstrations or whatever. And so Thomas Jefferson made the lawn in front of the Pantheon here to also be that place for dialogue and for discussion and for interaction. So that's what a university would be for him. It would be about that dialogue. And then the fourth thing was that he was also reminding us of the power and the majesty of Rome. You know, could we be as long-lasting as the Roman Empire? Could the United States be this great power like the Roman Empire? So by using this illusion, he's tapping into some of that real strength that we associate with Rome. So there are four things, four messages that are indirect, these associations with the Pantheon. Number one, it's about democracy. Number two, it's about unification. Number three, it's about interaction and dialogue. And number four, it's about permanence and power. So with this one emblem, he's conveying those messages to the educated young men, at this time not women, that would come to the University of Virginia. And then he housed in that the library being that sanctity of books and knowledge all contained in there. And Thomas Jefferson did love his library. I mean, it was really books were how, that was the key to the future, to learning, to knowledge. And then around the sides of that big lawn, he then had little pavilions. There's a pavilion, there's another pavilion, and then an arcade that connected all of those pavilions. So this great arcade around three sides, the pavilions. One of them would have been for the mathematics professor. One of them would have been for the English professor. One of them would have been for the Greek and Latin professor. And they actually would live in that house on the upper floor. They would have the classes on the lower floor. And then in the spaces in between, there are little rooms for the students that open out onto that arcade. So the students and the faculty and the classes would all be in this arcade that was arms that reached out from the library in the center. So all carefully orchestrated to say something about the kind of educational institution he was proposing. It's conveying meaning and inventing this new thing and giving it a stature and a role that's very clear by its design. Now, to this day, that yard and that ensemble of buildings is amazingly powerful on the University of Virginia campus. If you're the very top of the top of your senior class, you get to live on the yard in one of those really crappy dormitory rooms that were really built for the 18th, 19th century. But it's an honor to get to live on the yard. And if you're a very, very distinguished faculty member, like a dean of one of the schools, you might live in one of those pavilions that were originally designed for the faculty at University of Virginia. It still conveys a power and a meaning in those buildings. Okay, that's literal indirect communication. What are you supposed to think about literally? It's the Pantheon. But indirectly, we're supposed to think about all these other messages. Now, other examples of literal indirect communication. Sometimes there are symbols or emblems that we don't necessarily associate with another building, but we associate with just their form, and we get messages from that. And this is how, by combining those things together, we get the ability to say, oh, that's a church. Well, why does that look like a church or feel like a church to you? There's some combination of, I don't know, Gothic arches, steeples, stained glass. Some of those things are associated with church. These days, it's a different set of symbols that may be associated in particular with a different kind of church. And very different these days, like if you go to an old, 50-year-old Episcopal church, it's going to have a certain kind of communication about what being an Episcopalian is. If you go to a brand new, ecumenical church, no brand name, community church, it's going to use different symbols and emblems. It's not going to have stained glass and Gothic arches. So each religion has a way of communicating what its character is. And in the same way, you could say that about schools, or in this case, we're going to be looking at town halls. So we'll look at a series of town halls over time. How did they communicate their role in the community as the center of civic government? And the first we're looking at is one of the earliest town halls anywhere. It's called the Doge's Palace. It's in Venice. And the Doge was like the mayor of Venice. This was Italy at the time, they had city-states, so there would have been a whole region that the Doge controlled, which was that city-state around Venice. And this was the Doge's Palace. This was the center of civic government. He lived there, but also all of the civic governmental functions were in the Doge's Palace. And I'm going to say there are five things that had meaning and together made the message that this was a town hall. The first is a tower. And the tower says, this is the center of our town. This is the center of government. It's a marker that says this spot is special. And so there's the Tour San Marco sitting right by the Doge's Palace and saying, this is the center of town and the center of government. Second thing is these little focal balconies, like there and there. It's where they've got the flag out. And originally, that would have been a place where, when a decision was made by the council, then the Doge might go out on that balcony and make a pronouncement to the people below, this is the decision we've made. So that was celebrated by this emblematic balcony, this fancy balcony, that became a kind of focal point for making those announcements. What? Okay. So we have the tower, we have the focal balcony. The third thing is, remember that, keep the image in your head of the Doge's Palace. At the bottom, there are all these arcades, very penetrable, very open arcades, as you can see here and there. And those arcades are a way where you can be a citizen on the outside, but kind of interface with what's happening on the building on the inside. Yeah, hero, sort of, Luke. I don't know, do we get boos at the... Okay, we're back. All right, so we have the arcades where it says that the citizenry can participate in this building. They can come into the building, but, you know, at the periphery of it. But it seems open to the public. So that's a third message. The tower says it's the center of town. The focal balcony says there's a power figure that might give you a message. The third is the arcade. It's for the people to penetrate. The fourth is there's a courtyard in the center. It's a donut-shaped building. And that courtyard is a place where the privileged, you know, people in the town, the ones who represent everybody else, they might be able to come in and participate in a courtyard, which is kind of outdoors, but kind of within the realm of the building as well. And then the fourth thing is this stair, and the idea that there's something on the second floor up here that's elevated, that's important, and there's kind of a grand stair that takes you up to that. So four elements that just in their function tell us something about the building: the tower, the focal balcony, the arcade, the courtyard, and the stair, but also give meaning. And when we put those things together, we see that they begin to tell us about the kind of public or civic function of this building. Now, that very early example began to then encourage a building type to form. So this is the Campidoglio in Rome. It was done about 100 years later. So Venice had their town hall. 100 years later, in Rome, they're building their town hall. They build it on the Capitoline Hill. And Michelangelo is the architect for this. And it really is made of three buildings. And those three buildings are their center of civic government. But they use the same elements to say This is the center of our government. So they use the tower, which you can see because it's on the top of a hill. You can see it from all over Rome, the tower. And then there also is this focal balcony, this thing right here, where somebody could come out and make a pronouncement. There is this stair. It's at the top of a hill. And so there are all these stairs that take you up there. And it seems like it's important and elevated kind of function. There is this arcade, big, deep arcade that goes around here so that people can kind of participate within the building. There's that focal balcony again. And there also is this courtyard where the three buildings make a kind of semi-public space between them. So the tower, the focal balcony, the arcades, the courtyard, the stairs, all of those things repeating those messages to reinforce this as a town hall, as a building type. Now, over the next few centuries, every town hall had those characteristics. That was just something you could use to code. This is the nature of this building. This is what goes on here. So by the 1920s, we have Ragnar Olsberg building the town hall for Stockholm, Sweden, on a very prominent site in the archipelago with beautiful views from the water all around. And he does a tower, predictable. Now we don't actually have somebody coming out making announcements, but there still is the remnant of that in these little focal balconies that happen right here. So we get that sense of somebody could come out and make a pronouncement there. It's built around a courtyard again. There are the stairs that take you up into the building in an elevated sense. And there is actually also a courtyard inside. This is called the Blue Court. And because the weather's so crappy in Stockholm, they have an outdoor courtyard, but they also have an indoor courtyard. So if it's really cold, the sort of semi-public crowd could come in there. And then they have this arcade, which actually goes all the way under the building like that. So again, the tower, the focal balcony, the courtyard, the stair, the arcade, those same things now telling us this is a town hall. And you can carry that even further into like a more modern building like the City Hall in Boston. And in this case, we have towers. There's actually a building next door that is a government office building. But then the lower building has the kind of focal balcony shape that actually is the council chamber right there. That one is the mayor's office over on the other side. But that sense of here's a concentration of power. And of course, they're not walking out and making the pronouncement. It comes on TV. But, the building still says there are those emblems of powerful people or groups of people. It has the arcade all at the bottom, so it's penetrable and people can participate with it. It has the courtyard in the center. It's donut shaped the same way. And it also has this big stair, in a very grand way, takes you up to that courtyard and into the building. And also, once you go in the lobby, there's a big flight of stairs that take you up. And then, of course, all the important things happen on an upper level. All of these things become codified into what tells us that's a town hall. And the same kind of thing happens in churches or in schools or in banks or in other kinds of things. So there's ways that that literal indirect communication is then conveyed in a larger sense to a bigger building type. So there's literal direct communication, literal indirect communication, and then the third kind of communication I told you about was more abstract communication. And this is where we just get the message by shape or color or light or feeling. And in this case, we're looking at a church that is not using literal indirect communication. Many churches do. They maybe have columns in the front, or maybe they have Gothic windows, or they have stained glass. This one is more abstract. But it is an ascendant form. It looks like it's reaching to the heavens. It also is a kind of spiritual form. It has that looser, more emotional kind of feeling to it. So that its engagement with the heavens makes you kind of think of religious things, and also it's obviously not an office building or a housing condominium or anything like that. There is something that gives it a kind of spiritual quality in its color and its shape and its proportion, its line, the verticality reaching up to heaven. And then inside it does actually have stained glass, but now not stained glass that shows Mary and Jesus and all of the saints and things like that, but just abstract stained glass that just gives color. Very pungent, rich, kind of emotional color. Deep, rich red, or deep blue, or bright yellow. These, you know, dramatic, emotional kinds of colors. And then that light comes in a very sensuous way and washes these curvilinear walls of the building as they ascend up. And then in the very center, there is a piece of sculpture that is hung there. And it's made of thousands and thousands of little pieces of stainless steel. So they catch all the light, and they reflect it, and they seem shimmery. It's almost like an angel or a vision or, you know, so clearly the combination of that huge space on the inside, the great verticality of it, the darkness in general, but then with this splash of colored light, the ephemeral kind of reflections on this delicate stained glass, delicate stainless steel sculpture. All of those things together give us a very religious feeling. But it's abstract communication. It's color, shape, light, space, those things that are giving the message. Now, another really good example of this, I think, is the LBJ Library down the way over here. Again, a little bit like Thomas Jefferson, this was actually the first purpose-built presidential library on a university campus. That had never been done before. So how do I communicate what the role of this building is on the UT campus? It shouldn't look like the library down the way or like student housing. It's meant to look like the special purpose. And it also maybe is meant to depict something about LBJ himself, about this particular president. And I don't know, go out there. I'm not going to show a bunch of pictures of it because it's just up down the street, but go out and look at it and think, what does that say to me about LBJ? There certainly are plenty of people that would say that it's a very powerful building. It's got a large scale. It seems authoritarian. This was not a timid president, LBJ. This guy had power, and he knew how to exercise power. And the building kind of gives that sense of real authority and power. It also is, on the campus, it's kind of dominating. This is a special object set apart from the rest of the campus. And that's inside and outside. It's conveying something about the presidency. It's conveying something about the role of this presidential library on the UT campus. It's conveying something about LBJ himself and the kind of president he was. And that was very carefully worked out with LBJ and Lady Bird, who were the clients of it. The architect was Gordon Bunshaft. His firm is SOM. But I think it was very intentional, this idea of what are we communicating about that presidency. And maybe it'd be very different from, say, the presidency of Barack Obama or the presidency of, you know, whoever to come. Now, this is a building we looked at several lectures ago, the Jewish Museum in Berlin. And I mentioned at the time, this is a very, very powerful museum. And it's meant to say something about this horrible event in German history, the Holocaust. And so by the materials and by the shape and by the color, in an abstract way, it is telling you about this dour, depressing, kind of violent event. And by the pattern of the windows, by the kind of uneasiness and shifting and dislocation of some of the forms by the materials, this gray, dark material. It's telling you something about the Holocaust. And then when you go inside, it's got that same kind of violent juxtaposition of pieces. And it's meant to be telling you about the diaspora of the Jews in Germany even before the Holocaust, putting them in ghettos and then mistreating them and exiling them. All of these things that are now communicated just in these shapes and forms and spaces in the building. And it's possible to give people a real feeling of that by their experience of the building. So I mentioned, I think, that this one, the museum actually was completed as a building, but they didn't occupy it for several years. It was very controversial exactly what the content of the exhibits would be. And so, because they didn't have any exhibits to put in it, they just left it. But then people were very curious, and they requested that they be allowed to go inside the building. So they began to open it up, and you could get a tour of the building completely empty. And there were many people who thought, just leave it like this. It communicates about the Holocaust and the Jewish experience in Germany just exactly like it is. You don't need didactic things. You don't need little artifacts with labels on them, that we can understand something about it profoundly by just the space itself. In the end, they did create exhibits and make a more conventional museum. But the building itself had enough meaning, enough content on its own. Okay, I want to spend a minute, and I did not read the Twitter card responses at the beginning, and I want to read that, and then I'll give you the Twitter card question for today. The Twitter card question last time was, of those eight characteristics of humanism at a larger scale, which ones did you think were most important or most meaningful to you? Let me read a few of those responses. And they were all across the board. Pretty much every one of those eight had somebody who thought that was the most meaningful of the eight. So someone says, a sense of human presence stood out the most to me. Why enjoy all the convenient accommodation if there's no company to enjoy it with? Works that appear untouched and unoccupied remind me of a magnificently designed cake. It looks too pretty to eat. So you need to have human occupation. Someone else says, the most important of the eight is periodic natural relief. We are animals, and it seems we often put ourselves above nature, and it is sometimes disorderly. Natural elements serve as a reminder to us that we aren't just robots. Someone else on the same topic says, periodic natural relief is very important. Because of the busyness of life, you need a place to reconnect. Nature shows us where we came from in the midst of our synthetic lifestyles. Someone else says, accommodation of activity is definitely the principle that makes the most sense to me, because that's what life is about, a collection of experiences. So architectural design should accommodate and celebrate that. These activities are simply not possible without the necessary venues. On the same topic, somebody says, from the eight principles of humanism, I believe that accommodation of activity is the most important. I grew up in a city that did not have a strong pool of activities. That resulted in several young people I knew going down the wrong path because they had nothing better to do. The city didn't offer any alternatives. Someone else says, convenience is the one aspect that stands out to me because it was lacking where I grew up. Nothing we needed was close by, and pedestrians were a rare sight because travel by car was completely necessary for everything. Driving a car has become one of my least favorite experiences because of how much time I've spent in them. Someone else says, the principle I like the most is the range of people accommodated. This, to me, is really what humanism is at a larger scale. It isn't just about meeting the needs of one person. It's finding a way to meet the needs of many different kinds of people. If everyone feels comfortable where they are, then the whole community lives in harmony. And on the same topic, someone else says, the range of people accommodated is something I never experienced at home. I never experienced at home in Laredo, Texas. Almost everything that happens in the city seems to only seem important to conservative, traditional folks. It's not until recently that Laredo has warmed up to the idea of hosting a wider variety of people and events. Now that I'm here in Austin, I realize how much this factor can improve one's way of living. So the Twitter card question today is to try to think of an example of a place. And again, we've done this before in your hometown, in your school, in your here on the UT campus, in somewhere you've traveled, that conveys some kind of specific meaning. And what does it convey? So maybe it's a church you visited somewhere that gave you a particularly religious feeling, that really communicated what religion was in some particular way. Maybe it was a school that seemed to talk a lot about educational enterprise. Maybe it was a hospital that really, you know, made you very conscious of health. Maybe it was a campus that